And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to your next long-awaited installment of The Two Brandons. I'm Brandon Thomas.
And this is Brandon Easton.
And we are back at you after a long time away. Been a very, very busy summertime for me and Easton both. A variety of projects we're working on. Some of the stuff has been announced. Not everything has, but it's been a very exciting time for me personally. With Horizon and other projects on the horizon.
Pretty much.
And my man Easton, it's been great to see him, get out there and have the launch of Mask from IDW, the Vampire Hunter D book from Stranger Comics on the backs of the, how much money did the Kickstarter make? It was quite a bit, right?
$107,000.
Wow. That's crazy. So Vampire Hunter D number one actually just launched in stores last Wednesday, sold out of the print run completely, going to a second print. An amazing, amazing first issue. Great job by my man Easton and artists like Michael Brassard. I don't know. You have a couple of guys on there. I don't have it in front of me. But, you know, if that's a book you guys are looking to get into, it just started last Wednesday. Second print will be in stores real soon. And it's exciting to see, man. I mean, I'm always excited for my own stuff, obviously, but it's always exciting to see, you know, my friends and compatriots out there with their own projects, you know, building and growing. And it's cool. You know, I love being able to go to the comic shop on Wednesdays and pick up books, you know, that are written and illustrated by people I know, you know, a lot of hardworking people that have put in a lot of time and are finally getting the opportunity to get that spotlight that they've deserved. So it's great to see. It's a great time for us both. And that's my way of kind of apologizing for being away so long. But we're back and we're gonna talk about a variety of things today. I know you want to talk a little bit about the overall development process. You know, how
yes.
we have developed some of the projects that we're working on, the difference between working on a creator-owned book and something that is owned by a company or a licensed book, which is a completely different animal, but it's fun for completely different reasons. So I love it, whether it's creator-owned or whether it's licensed stuff. There's always, you know, I love making comics. I love writing comics and having the opportunity to collaborate with these, you know, great writers, great artists. And, you know, I'm going to turn everything into a sports analogy as usual, but it's cool kind of being, I guess sometimes you're the quarterback of the team or the offensive coordinator. It's hard to kind of break it down, everybody's individual roles, but it's great.
I mean, that's the trick. It's all about collaboration.
Yeah.
Whether you're talking about a football team, a baseball team, basketball, if you're talking about Congress, if you're talking about a voting block, you know, it's a group of people coming together with a shared goal. And comic books are unique in the sense that it is very much an assembly line mentality.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, you know, starts with the writer. And this is by no way and no means diminishing the role of the illustrator and the art team, because without the art, you don't have a comic book.
Nope. But you just have a Word document or a final draft document, I guess, in our case.
Or a really horrible script. So, you know, what you got to do is understand the needs of the medium itself before you even sit down to start developing, and realizing that no matter what you do, you're going to have an illustrator come along and help you along in the process. Because I can tell you, I'd say 85% of the stuff I've done has been enhanced by the illustrators on such a level that I can't even put it to words how great some of the illustrators I've worked with have been. And, you know, specifically like Dennis Medry, who did the Andre the Giant, who drew my Andre the Giant biography script. That guy, like, I never met him. I've never talked to him in person, but somehow he understood exactly what I wanted from and what I had in my heart and mind when he drew the Andre the Giant book. I was blown away by what he came up with. Same thing with Tony Vargas with the Mobile Armor Strike Command. His work on Mask has been extraordinary. Mike Broussard, the brother who drew Vampire Hunter D. I mean, good God almighty. I mean, you've seen what it looks like. So
it's a fantastic looking book.
Yeah, and thank you for your kind words earlier. And just like you said, Vampire Hunter D was released on November 11th, which was last Wednesday as of this recording. And it is still available in some stores. But as usual, a lot of retailers, because of the way Diamond operates, underordered that book like on a criminal level. It was criminally underordered. So basically what I want folks to know is you can probably still get a first print, but a lot of those first print copies are going to be worth a whole lot of money, just like the first issue of Walking Dead was, because that was completely underordered way back in the day. So if you are close to your local comic book shop or you order directly from StrangerComics.com, you might be able to get a first print, but I'm telling you, those first prints are almost gone even at the warehouse at Stranger Comics. Because I was just over there, and there's almost nothing left. And I'm talking about like 7 or 8 copies. So I'm not even kidding.
That's great.
So yeah, so that's been fantastic. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about with Brandon, because I haven't had a chance to really talk to Thomas here since really Comic-Con.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he's doing some great stuff that I don't know that much about with Lion Forge Comics, who I still work with. But Brandon has gotten hired to work on their new Catalyst Prime universe. I don't know what he's doing. But we're going to get a little bit of that, you know, soon. But before we even get into Catalyst Prime at Lion Forge, I had wanted to talk to Thomas about Horizon, which is this, you know, blockbuster book from Image Comics. It's a space opera, science fiction, action, adventure, thriller. That's the best way I can think of it, about aliens coming to Earth to prevent their own planet from being destroyed by humanity. And the first thing I'll say is that, you know, when Brandon had told me about he was doing some secret project with Skybound and Image, he had been working on it for quite some time. And because of my bad memory, he would tell me that he worked on it, and I completely forget. And I'd be like, hey, what are you working on? And he'd be like, I told you already. I'm like, oh, well, maybe you did. I don't know. But one of the things I wanted, you know, we had already discussed, but I definitely wanted to get into was the fact that more so than myself, Thomas has done a lot of creator-owned material. He's worked on DC Comics, and he's done the Voltron book over at Dynamite. But he's had some very strong, critically acclaimed original material that he's developed from scratch. And I know we have a lot of listeners who are, you know, aspiring writers and undiscovered talent out there. And I wanted to talk to him about, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it too. But first, I wanted to talk to Thomas about, you know, when you were developing Horizon, like, where did you even begin with this? Like, how did you come up with an idea of this kind of universe? And how do you approach your original ideas from scratch? So before we even get into Horizon, I guess, where do you start with? Like, what is the foundation for the seeds of your ideas to be made into comic books?
Well, it's a little different every time. And in the case of something like Miranda Mercury, which was a book that came out a few years ago and will soon be coming out again. Stay tuned for details on that. But with Miranda, it was the character, right? It was just, you know, this kind of space hero, kind of like in a very, I don't want to call her like an archetype, but it was more of a kind of like a classic space hero, you know, like your Flash Gordon. There's a lot of, you know, Indiana Jones in there, even though that's not set in space. But in the case of Miranda, it was that character. It was this black female science hero that came to me first. And then all of the things that kind of went into her character came afterwards. Like, for instance, at the very beginning, she wasn't the latest in a long line of, you know, black science fiction adventurers, which came later and which was a hugely, you know, indispensable part of her character that I didn't have completely down, but I had kind of like the image of her in my head, and I had that name, you know, Miranda Mercury. And from there, everything kind of built out. So Miranda, if you guys haven't read it, it's a very kind of like old school science fiction action serial. every single issue is a complete story, beginning, middle, and end. So every issue, you know, has an adventure with Miranda and her partner, Jack Warning. They're on different planets. They're fighting different villains. You know, different characters are being introduced in every single issue. And all of the issues are complete stories onto themselves. But there are there is like a subplot that's thread through all of the issues that kind of culminates in a larger way down the road. But with Miranda was kind of a everything that I love about comic books and science fiction. It's a lot of Star Wars, obviously. I think there's probably like a Star Wars reference in almost every issue that we did. Like I said, a lot of Indiana Jones and kind of this idea of comics, you know, this kind of what I call kitchen sink comics, where it's just like shit being thrown at you, you know, too fast for you to really even absorb everything on one reading. You know, my favorite comics are books that I can find something different to love about every single time I read them. And that's very much what Miranda Mercury was designed to be. You know, when you sit down and you read it the first time, obviously it's supposed to be enjoyable and you're supposed to be able to get into it and appreciate it. But I wanted to kind of leave things for that second, you know, that second reading or that third reading, you know, things that are kind of really buried in there, because, you know, as you've read Miranda, and there's a lot of there's a lot of great kind of subtext going on in a lot of those stories that allows them to operate on more than one level. Another thing about Miranda was it was a challenge for myself, because at the time I really felt that something that was deficient in my kind of abilities as a storyteller were telling done in one stories. At that time, every story that I was coming up with was some like large running epic, you know, arc where it needed at least five or six issues to turn into something. And so Miranda Mercury was an opportunity for me to really kind of dive in and really work on some mechanical stuff, like the ability to actually tell a satisfying story in 20 something pages is really, really, really difficult. And so I feel like I learned a lot about myself as a writer, and I got a lot better as a writer having to figure out these kind of interesting ways to cut in and out of these stories and get them done in 20 something pages and still have them kind of being like a satisfying whole of a larger story. So that is kind of how Miranda Mercury went. In the case of Horizon, it was all about the premise. You know, I had this premise probably 5 or 6 years ago, and I developed it a little bit, but it was one of those things that I kind of wrote down and never really came back to. But the very basic idea of Earth invades another planet, it's kind of like how Horizon started. And it just seemed, I don't know, it seemed obvious to me. So it was one of those things that I had kind of written down, and I'm like, oh, well, hopefully I'll get to that before someone else catches up to me. But what happened was that when Skybound approached me and asked me to pitch some things, you know, Horizon was, I forget what it was even called then, because it's had several different names. You know, Horizon might have been the third or fourth title that the book actually had. I think for a while it was called Insurgent. So, you know, it was one of those things that I felt like was a really intriguing hook. And I don't want to say it was easy to pitch, but there is something about it that people could understand really, really quickly. You know, you just give them that, you know, that one sentence, Earth is invading another planet. And it's like, what? Oh, okay. I understand that. And that's kind of how we started. And the process, like you said, with Skybound, it was a pretty lengthy process. It was a little over 2 years from the time I started working on it to the time it was announced as a, you know, as a comic. And we did a lot of different kind of walkthroughs. So I would plot out And for all you aspiring writers out there, I don't advise you to do this. It's something that works for me, but you really have to have a very good, stable relationship with whatever editor you're working with, because it's very possible to send your editor so much material that they're just like, I don't want to read this shit. I don't have time to, you know, to read this. But luckily in my case, you know, the editors at Skybound were very fond of Miranda Mercury, and they were, you know, they were willing to, they were willing to read through all of this stuff. So what I would do, I would send them like 15 to 18 issues. You know, I would just plot the whole thing out, and I would write maybe like a half a page to three quarters of a page in Word for each issue. Like, that's how detailed it was. That's how I tend to write my outlines. They're insanely detailed. So I would send them like, you know, 10, 11 pages of just plots and like, oh, and then this happens, and then this character turns this way. And then, so we did that for probably maybe 6 to 9 months, and they always gave me great notes. They always said things like, okay, well, this is working, so let's do more of this, let's do less of this. And one of the big discussions while we were developing it was initially, like, I don't know if you guys have read Horizon, there are four main alien characters. There are some human characters that are being slowly worked into the book. But initially, there were like seven characters, like the squad of, you know, of alien insurgents. There were like six or seven of them. And that was one of the main things that hit the cutting room floor, you know, making sure that core of characters was very tight and focused. So what I did was, some of those characters that got cut from the Earth mission are still on the home planet of Valius, and we're actually going to check in with some of those guys occasionally and see what kind of what role they have in the mission worlds away. So it was just a very, you know, I've never really gone through that type of process with a company before, where I actually had editors reading the stuff and giving me feedback and allowing me to kind of develop it and make it better and better and better before I even sat down to write the scripts. And I think because of that, I had a much better handle on the characters and on the world before I even had to sit down and write that script. You know, I knew Xia Malin, I knew her so much, you know, so much better than if I would have just kind of written a couple of plots and, you know, just started writing, which is what I would have done if it was just me in a room. You know, if it was just me doing it, I probably would have gone with maybe my first or second idea. But going through the development process with Skybound, it allowed me to go with like my fourth or fifth idea. And I always feel that the more cracks I have at something, the better and more refined the idea is gonna get. And I think that you can really, you know, you can really feel that there's kind of a comfort level with me and this kind of writing this cast of characters separately and together that I wouldn't have had if I didn't have this very extensive and at times grueling development process.
Wow. And that's a lot.
Yes.
But that's the thing, is I think that it's important to, you know, illuminate and demystify the creative process, because I do believe one of the reasons people don't always respect comic book writers or comic book creators is because I don't think they realize how much work goes into it and how much pain and suffering and blood and sweat and effort goes mm-hmm. into something, only to, you know, release it and then have people get online, tear it apart without really understanding what you're trying to do, one, and how hard you worked on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's deeply important, at least from my perspective, that people learn. I think it's better for a fan if they understand the process. Like, a lot of people don't agree with that, but as I started off a fan and I've actually been lucky enough and fortunate enough to work in this business, I see how much goes into it. And I know for a fact nobody goes into a comic book trying to make something that makes people angry.
Right.
You know, no one is trying to create a book or a TV show or a film that people are going to, you know, eviscerate online. So I think it's I really appreciate the fact that, you know, you're delving into the fact that this is how much of work you put into it. This is your thought process.
Yeah.
And it's not something that comes along easily. It's something you have to really take the time to develop. You know, in a few times I've done, you know, my original stuff, whether it be Shadow Law or all these unreleased things that I can't get an artist to finish, like Dominion's Light, you know, I would always ask myself the question, what is out there that I would like to see that nobody's doing?
Uh-huh.
Because there's a lot of stories that are haven't been told yet, you know. And it's not even about race. It's not about gender. It's not about this or that. It's nothing political. It's just that there are a lot of stories from certain perspectives that just haven't been told in pop culture. And now that we have so many people of color and so many women and so many folks who are gay and lesbian and transgender who are entering the business and are getting to take their experiences that are not always politicized. Because
right.
You can tell a story about otherness. It doesn't have to be political. You could just tell a story that shines a light on what you're feeling, which is really a universal thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And, you know, going on that point, that's a lot of what Horizon is. You know,
right.
Horizon is about alienation and misunderstanding. And it's about what I started saying, the hypocrisy of survival. How it's okay for certain people to take certain, kind of desperate, hostile, violent steps in order to survive, in order to preserve themselves. But then when other people do it, it's looked down upon and it's branded as, you know, as some kind of, you know, some kind of attack against what is considered to be kind of the accepted culture or the accepted perspective. And I mean, mm-hmm. here, one of the most interesting things about doing the series is you really get to examine how human beings would look to, you know, another alien race. You know, I mean, just like look at the state of our, and, you know, this is not one of those, everything is not backwards, everything is not falling down, but a lot of shit is. And if you had no context and no perspective for the, you know, the kind of totality of human experience and existence, if you were just dumped here and looked around, you would be like, these people are out of their fucking minds. Like, what's even happening here? Like, and you wouldn't want human beings showing up on your planet talking about, hey, we need this. You know, we messed up our stuff and now we've come here to mess yours up. So that's one thing that's been kind of one of the themes that's running through Horizon. And I really want to make it difficult for people to know who to actually root for. I mean, do you root for the alien characters to basically, you know, burn our world down and trap us on it? You know, is all of humanity bad? I mean, those are the kind of central questions that we're delving into when people aren't running and getting beat up. So.
Yeah, and I'm listening. I'm just like enthralled by this. I'm like listening to everything you're saying, bro. Because like, for those who are listening, I didn't know what he was doing for years, even though he would tell me, well, I'm working on this project, and I'd forget that. But he never would actually tell me what it was until the actual press release got released by Skybound and Image. So I'm learning just like you're learning as I'm listening to this. So I'm just sitting here like,
that's
wow,
another big thing about working in comics is the ability to keep a secret longer than you are comfortable keeping it. I mean, I told you a little about, you know, what I was doing in passing, but you have to be very conscious of, be very careful with the dissemination of information and stuff that you're working on and people that you're working with, because, you know, and it's not, it's not always a malicious thing, but people get excited, you know, like you're excited, right. And then you tell, you know, your closest friends about it, and then they get excited. But every time you tell someone, it increases the chance that that news will kind of leak out, even unintentionally, before it's supposed to. And one of the, I've said this before, but I didn't realize how much of a weight having to keep Horizon a secret was until I didn't have to do it, until I was on the stage talking about it. And I got off the stage at the Image Expo and I felt, you know, I felt like the weight just come off of me, and I didn't even realize it was there. You know, I was just putting my head down and trying to work hard and trying to get better and do a great job on these scripts, that I didn't even realize kind of like the emotional toll it was taking, having to keep something that was so exciting and so kind of, you know, like fulfilling, to keep it a secret from people. So that's something that you'll also have to develop. If you want to work in comics and entertainment, because there have been instances where I've announced things much too early, and people always remember, you know, people always remember when you announce something, and then if it's like 2.5 years later, it's like, I mean, well, why did you announce it if it wasn't ready? Like, why did you announce it if it wasn't going to come out? You know, why didn't you wait until it was closer to being done? And so, you know, you always have to be mindful of that. And then, you know, picking up on something else you said, I have such an appreciation. I mean, I had an appreciation for good and great comics before, but doing comics, you know, there are so many opportunities for them not to be great and for things to get lost in translation through no one's, you know, particular fault. But when you have so many hands that are touching something, to have it come out the other end and be something that's, you know, enjoyable and excellent, and that is going to hold up, you know, longer than like 6 months in time, it's really an achievement. And it's really something that I've grown to appreciate even more than I did before.
Yeah. I mean, you know, well, one of the things that Thomas is talking about right now is the non-disclosure agreement that you have to sometimes sign, mm-hmm. because, and what that is, for those who might not be aware of all the legal stuff behind the scenes, it's an NDA, or non-disclosure agreement, is something that is set up by a company that you're hired with to not say anything about what you're working on. So basically, you're being sworn to secrecy by a legal contract. And if you violate that, not only will you be fired, but you could also be sued for potential damages that your early blabbing can do to a project, because sometimes the surprise of the release is as much a part of the creative process as the actual project itself, mm-hmm. as the product itself. And I can tell you, you know, I was working with a variety of people over the years, and this is something I did not intend to talk about, but I'm glad you brought it up, is about when to announce things and when to not announce things. I've gotten into some really nasty debates with people who I deeply respect and like, but I've worked with, who would hold certain things that I was working on so tightly that by the time they finally announced it, nobody cared, because there had been no, like, you know, kind of early hype. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to announce everything, but sometimes if you release a part of an image, or you release a one sheet, which is like a advertisement type of a form that you put out there that can go as a press release. Also, it can be given out at comic book shops. You see one sheets all the time. But if you don't say something and then you let people know only 2 weeks before it's coming out, and it's an original concept that does not have anything to do with a Marvel or DC or pre-established a property, you can do a lot of damage. But if you announce it too early, then people are going to be sitting around waiting with their arms crossed, being like, when is this thing going to come out? So you do have to be very, very careful about when you release your information, when you start leaking artwork out. But there's a double-edged sword. If you go too early, people will lose interest. But if you do it too late, no one will have enough pre-interest to even step into a comic book shop or a bookstore or anywhere to pick up your property or pick up your project. So That's a very, very tricky thing. I mean, I've learned that over the years because back when I did Shadow Law, I thought Shadow Law was going to be out by 2008 because I started working on it in 2004. And I was dropping stuff for Shadow Law as early as 2005 and 6 and 7. And obviously the book didn't drop until January 2012. So, however, because I had spent almost a decade hyping it, I had enough pre-established heat and hype that people did at least want to check it out. But if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't do it that way, you know. And there was other projects I worked on that when they dropped, nobody knew because nobody had been hyping it.
Yeah.
So it's something to think about in regards to how you approach hyping your material, where you decide to hype it, and who you hype it to. You know, as I've gotten older and I've started to get booths and tables at conventions, I'm learning that being on the floor at a convention is probably the best way to hype yourself because you're having we've all said this before, but when you have face-to-face communication with people and you get to shake hands and you get to give out stuff, it's a lot different than just hyping it on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or Tumblr. You know, people need to – I'm realizing that people have to see you.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken me a long time to get to this point because I personally don't like doing conventions because it's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between writing a book, hyping a book, paying for a book, doing everything you got to do, then to have to do the actual footwork of being at a convention, particularly when it's your booth. Not if you're just coming to sign.
Right, but
When you have
coming to sign is easy.
Yes, in and out. But I'll give you an example. Like, I've worked with Stranger Comics, and we've been hyping Vampire Hunter D for the last 6 months or so, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ever since summertime. Actually, before summertime. But the trick is, when I'm doing Stranger Comics, I'm not building a booth. I'm not setting a booth up. I'm not breaking a booth down. Now, at the last Stan Lee's Kamikaze, which they now call L.A. Comic-Con for some reason, I had a booth. I had my own table or whatever, right? And I had to load up. I had to unpack the car. I had to put my table together. Then at the end of that day, I had to unpack, hide everything under the table, clean up, go home, sleep a little bit, get there early so I can get a parking spot.
Right.
Then put my booth, put my table back together, pull everything up, and do the whole thing again for another 12 hours. You know, so you have about 18 to 20 hours of actual hard work. And I'm not talking about just sitting down, because if you're at a table, you need to be standing up. You need to be talking to people, shaking hands, handing out stuff, ready to pitch your stuff consistently.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really hard work. And I respect those brothers and sisters and all. I mean, I'm talking about everybody, white folks, everybody. I respect anyone in this industry who does a lot of conventions, because I could not imagine having to ship my material from show to show to show. I cannot imagine driving from state to state and having to unpack, set up a booth and table, sell hard all weekend, unpack, break it all down, and then either go to another show or go home.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do that, you know? And I don't know. It just blows my mind. And it's just like, you know, working on, like, for example, like, I've been working on a lot of licensed books, meaning that they are not original things. They are properties that were basically rented from the people who actually own it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to work on it. Like, for example, I've done Transformers, which is a Hasbro property, but IDW basically rents Transformers from Hasbro. And now I'm working on Mask, which is also rented from Hasbro from IDW, in a sense. It's not literal renting, but that's what licensing properties basically boil down to.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Vampire Hunter D, which is owned by Hideki Kikuchi, who is still alive in Japan, writing new Vampire Hunter D material all the time. So when you're working on a property that you don't own, you have a whole different set of things to think about, a whole different set of things to work about, to work with. And you have to consider not only what you can bring to it, but you have to keep in mind that there are mandates in place for what you can and cannot do with these characters. Like when I did the Transformers Deviations, even though I was writing a Elseworlds Transformers story,
uh-huh.
there were things I could and could not do with those characters. Like, obviously, they can't curse.
Right.
And they can't do anything. Obviously, robots can't do anything sexual, but you can't have them in positions or in situations that could be read as sexually offensive or racially offensive or in any other way religiously problematic, you know.
Uh-huh.
So you have to be very careful when you, because that's a whole other level. Like, some people might think working on your own material is tough, but when you create it, you have all the rules in place. Mm-hmm. You've created the universe. You've created the economy. You've created the psychology. You've created the economics of your world. But when you're working on a licensed property, you have to fit in with not only what the main company, like, for example, Hasbro, wants you to do, but you also have to keep in mind all the stuff that's come before that the company that's hired you to write this book has already done.
Right.
And that's a very interesting balancing act as a creator, because it's a double-edged sword. And that seems to be the theme today. You
know, that's what we'll call it.
On one hand, writing media tie-ins, which is what they're really called. It's called media tie-ins. When you're writing a media tie-in, you get exposure to a larger audience who would know, who under most circumstances would not know your name, right? But the flip side is that you don't own it and you don't profit from it other than your original pay. You might get a couple of residual checks, maybe, depending on what company it is, here and there. But generally speaking, when I get paid to do the stuff I'm doing, I don't have any other fiscal benefit other than the original paycheck. And I'm not complaining, but this is the reality of it. Whereas if you own something like Brandon Thomas owns Horizon, if Horizon gets turned into a movie, right, he's going to benefit from that.
Mm-hmm. It's now, actually, we own it together, but I am one of the owners, right. Yeah.
But that's the trick, though. Like, right. You are a owner.
Yes.
Right? I am not a owner by any stretch of the imagination of Vampire Hunter D, Mobile Armor Strike Command, Transformers, or even, for example, the Andre the Giant book I did for Lionforge, right? Probably the most critically acclaimed material I've ever done.
It's a great book. That,
thank you. That got optioned into a film by Stone Village Pictures. I am not the writer of that movie. I would like to be, but I'm not the writer of that film. And not only that, but whatever financial deal happened between Stone Village Pictures and Lionforge, I am not a part of that, meaning I don't get a red cent from that deal. Now, I'm not upset by that because working on that book helped me pay my bills and rent and kept me alive during a very rough 2014. But the reality of the situation is that when you really break it down, while it's great that my name was put out further because of Andre the Giant, mm-hmm. in the absolute long term, I'm not going to benefit as much unless it was something I created from scratch.
Right.
So that's kind of the thing. And I'll give you a great example of this that everybody can understand. There was a lot of dudes out there back in the day who wrote like Star Wars novels, like Alan Dean Foster, and there's a guy named Donald J. Glut, and all the, or Glut, I don't know how to pronounce his name. There's all these people out there who've done all these novels over the years, right?
Yep.
And while, incidentally, what's that? Kevin J. Anderson is another guy.
Yeah, Timothy Zahn.
Timothy Zahn. There's a bunch of folks out there. I'm going back to the 70s.
Oh, okay, okay.
And I'm going, it's like a Donald Glut and Alan Dean Foster. And then you, recently you got Kevin J. Anderson and, Timothy Zahn and a bunch of other, Michael Stackpole, mm-hmm. you know, you got all these folks, right? With Dan Abnett, you know, who does a lot of the Warhammer 40K stuff. You know, when you think about these guys, right, they were able to assemble a critical mass of fandom based on the material they've created, mm-hmm. right? Then they started doing their own stuff, and then they were able to maybe slice a small piece of that larger fandom and get them to cross over. That's the hardest part of all, because you cannot guarantee people are going to jump from reading Star Wars and Star Trek novels or Aliens novels or Predator novels or, novels. There's no guarantee they're going to jump from that over to what original thing you've created. Right. However, that's a chance. That's not a bad chance to take.
Well, if you look at comics and you look at the creators in comics who are a big deal now, that's exactly what they did. They did independent books that very few people were reading, but it allowed them to garner enough attention from larger companies like Marvel and DC. So then they put in a couple of years working on the big characters, establishing a fan base, you know, with your Batman, your Captain America, your Spider-Man. do that for a few years, and then they go back to Image, and as long as they can take maybe like, I don't know, a quarter, 25 to 40% of that audience with them, they can make a comfortable living. And that's the, you know, that's the pattern that we've seen from, you know, a variety of writers like Rick Remender, Jonathan Hickman, Matt Fraction,
yep. you Kelly know, Sue DeConnick.
Yep, Kelly yep. Sue DeConnick. These are all creators that did did independent projects, got the attention of the big two or whatever, big three, whatever you want to call them, put in some good time, built up a reputation for putting out quality product, and now they can slice off a portion of that audience, do creator-owned books, and own everything, and still make a very, very good living as working comic book writers. And that's been kind of the path that most people have taken. There are some deviations from that, of course, but you know, it to me personally, I would like to do a mix, you know, until I didn't have to do a mix. Mm-hmm. Or something else to consider is like, once you become a name, you know, kind of like onto yourself, you get a lot more leeway and you get a lot more leverage to be able to like work on the characters you want. Because typically when you're starting out, if the big two offers you some C or D list character, it's like, you better take it. But once you kind of up your profile, then if Marvel or DC comes to you and says, hey, you know, we're interested in something, then you're like, all right, well, I want to write Batman, or I want to write something very specific that, because I have a name and because I have a profile, you'll just allow me to do without jumping through, right. you know, hoops. Because basically when you're a new writer in kind of mainstream comics, I don't want to say that you have to jump through hoops, but for me,
yeah, you do.
You do, but to me, yeah. what actually I think is a little more accurate is that things are taken away from you, right?
Yeah.
So you're writing a story, but you don't have any pages, or you can't use certain characters because the more high profile writers are using that character. Like if you're at Marvel right now and no one knows who you are, you're not going to get Dr. Doom for anything because, you know, Bendis is writing Dr. Doom as Iron Man. So just kind of that, you know, that creates its own challenge in itself. And that's how those companies determine who is going to continue on. Because the idea is that if we give you nothing and you can turn it into something, then if we give you a little more, you know, you'll keep getting better and you'll keep progressing kind of up the line. You know, that's kind of how it's supposed to work. That's not always how it is, but that's just kind of, you know, that's kind of how it works, right? Because you can't come in off the street and have access to all of the biggest characters and all the biggest villains because you haven't been jumped in yet, basically. You know, you haven't gone through, you know, kind of like the pain and struggle and anguish over how to make some character that no one cares about notable in some kind of way and like, you know, 11 pages, you know, and I use that obviously as an example because we both just did Marvel stories for the Civil War II anthology. And, I was, you know, I have to admit, I was jealous of Easton because Easton got what, like 4 or 5 more pages than I did for.
Man, you did fine for what you had. I bought your book. I bought the one Enrique did, Enrique Carrion, who's one of our colleagues.
Yeah. Look,
man, I had to fight real hard for that Night Thrasher pages because if you didn't read it, Civil War II is basically Carol Danvers versus Tony Stark, based on, you know, this guy named Ulysses, who's one of the new Inhumans, who has a power to, you know, divine the future. He can see the future. So the question is, do you operate and act on his visions, or does the fact that you're acting on his visions create the scenario that he describes? Right. That's also known as a predestination paradox, you know? So I'm getting to the serious time travel stuff here. So the trick is, I did a Night Thrasher story because I really want to bring him back. And I felt that Marvel had actually done me a major solid by bringing him back during the contest of champions, because I requested it quite some time ago and I had no idea it was going to be happening. Mm-hmm. So I have to thank the office of, I think it's Nick Moss. I want to say his name is. Is it Will Moss or Nick Moss?
Will Moss.
Will Moss and Chris Robinson, who were dealing with that particular side of the Marvel brand. And they brought him back, and I was able to use him for the Civil War II Choosing Size anthology. Now, the trick is, that's another example of how what it's like to work within a corporate structure, particularly one as tightly defined as Marvel Entertainment is. And I have no complaints about it. It's just that when you actually go through it, you really begin to understand how and why books come out the way they do, for better or for worse. Once again, this is not a complaint. This is just a statement of fact. You know, once you have that experience, right, you begin to understand, okay, this is why the editorial direction goes this way. This is why things flow that way. Now you get it. And for me, it's – and once again, I know people will obviously disagree with what I'm about to say. But I do believe that once you are a part of that system, it's a little bit more difficult to just blatantly crap on everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more difficult for me now, having gone through Marvel editorial process, to be like, oh, this person sucks or this thing sucks. I just can't shit on things now as easy as I could before, now having gone through the process. And I think that if it was possible for every hypercritical fan to somehow have that experience downloaded into their consciousness, I think you would see a completely different mindset when it comes to critique of comics online these days. And as Bill Burr, one of my favorite comedians, says, it's not everybody. All you need is 20 people to make a hashtag and suddenly you have a movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So if 20 people get online in the same like social media circles that you're in and say something sucks, suddenly it becomes sacrosanct. It becomes real. It becomes a thing. It becomes apocryphal.
Right.
And then everybody is saying, oh, this sucks. I always tell the great story about how I met the producer of the Beast Wars cartoon back in San Diego 99. I'll say it again because it was a major shift for me from being just a fanboy to beginning to understand what it takes to create popular, what it takes to create in a corporate controlled creative process. You know, it's not as simple as people think it is. So having gone through that, when you submit a script, that script is going to be torn to pieces by your editor, particularly at a company like Marvel. Now, it doesn't mean that your script was bad. It doesn't mean that they're being hypercritical. It means that they have an idea, a system of situations in place that you don't even know about,
right,
that they will make you aware of once you start changing things. Because they're going to say, well, this, this, and this is cool, but you can't do this, 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 and this because this, this, and this is going to happen down right. the line, and you can't affect that.
Right.
And once you begin to understand that, it changes your entire creative mindset. I mean, at least it did for me. I can't speak for other creators. But for me, it made me more aware of how these things actually work, how these things actually operate. And it changed my approach to corporate-controlled comic books. And again, I'm not saying corporate control as a slur. I'm saying as a statement of fact, because right. Marvel is owned by Disney. And even before that, they are a multinational corporation, a multi-billion-dollar corporation. You know, so it's something to think about when you're starting to create and you want to create and you in the back of your mind, someday you want to write for Marvel or DC, because really a lot of us, that's how we got into all this.
Uh-huh.
We fell in love with Marvel and DC characters. But once you actually get into it, once you actually touch down into it and you get into the muck and into the quicksand of it all, and I don't mean that as a negative, I really don't. Because what it is that you begin to understand what it takes to survive. You know, quicksand does not kill you like every 80s and 70s TV show made you think. You just have to walk your way through it. You know, like if you fall into a swamp, that does not mean you're going to drown. It means you need to just walk your way through it because it's complicated. You know, and working at Marvel for that short amount of time was very complicated, but not in a bad way, because mm-hmm. I learned how their editorial process works. And that is everything. That's the lesson that most writers, particularly in comics, do not get a chance to experience. And I am deeply grateful and thankful and fortunate to have had that experience.
Yeah, man. It's, you know, that was my, I guess that was my return to Marvel, but there were a lot of things that were very similar to how it was when I worked there previously back in like 2005. And there are a lot of things that are completely different, you know, from that time. So, it's always, you know, I guess it's unrealistic to think that every fan is actually going to have the chance to work in. It's like every fan or reviewer needs to do like an 8-pager for Marvel or DC Comics and then see how they feel about everything afterwards. But, I mean, you just, something I would say is don't make your mind up about anything. You know, if you want to work in comics and you want to do a certain thing and you kind of have this path kind of laid out in your head of exactly how it's going to go and how it's going to end up, I really encourage people to abandon that and to let go of these very kind of predetermined notions of what your career in comics is going to be. Or, you know, you need to have a goal, obviously, but my goal and my focus has changed dramatically. I mean, when I was first starting to break into comics, all I wanted to do is work at Marvel and DC, you know, forever and ever. I wanted an exclusive contract. You know, I wanted health insurance. I wanted stability. I wanted, seriously, this is what I wanted. I wanted health insurance and I wanted to be able to write Batman and Tim Drake Robin. And that's pretty much kind of what I wanted. But when you look at comics is always changing. And when you look at the kind of state of comics now, one of the things that I personally don't like is I don't like the fact that there are very few sustained runs in comics anymore. And that used to be how it was. It used to be that you would work in comics and you would get on a character and you would be on it for 50 or 60 issues. And at the end of it, you would have this great epic classic run of, you know, of comics that will stand the test of time and people will be talking about a decade later. Well, the comics is not really working like that, not on the big two side of things. Obviously, you know, there are creator-owned books that go on and on and on and until their natural completion. But from a mainstream point of view, I don't know if it's a market thing or I don't know what it is, but that's basically not the thing now. You know, now we have a lot of hit-and-run arcs, you know, where we'll have a creative team that's together for maybe, you know, 6 to 8 issues, maybe. And, you know, you get a nice little hardcover out of it, and then everybody goes on to another character. And personally, you know, that I don't like that personally. You know, I like these 60, 70-issue runs. You know, I like, you know, Bendis's, like, Ultimate Spider-Man run and his Daredevil run and Mark Waid's Daredevil run. You know, I personally like long, you know, I like the epic, you know, I like epic shit, you know, to my to my detriment sometimes. But you also have to kind of look at the landscape and adapt your, you know, your aspirations to what is actually happening in comics, you know, and don't kind of plant this flag in and just refuse to move off of it. I think it was Chris Rock said this in, you know, in one of his many comedy specials. He had this great riff about, you know, because you never know. You know, you never know what's going to happen. And you always have to keep that in mind. You never know where the next opportunity is coming from. You never know which assignment that someone will offer you or you'll have the chance to pitch for that you never, you know, you never even imagined would come your way. And personally, my thing has always been to get better and to keep learning. You know, I have this thing where I want to make a different mistake every time I write a script, you know, figure out that mistake for the next one and then make another one. So
I want to keep
advancing, keep learning. And, you know, it's tough. I don't want to pretend that it's not, but it's very satisfying and it's very fulfilling when it works. you know, when you and your collaborators get on the same page. And I'll bring up Horizon as an example. So before my artist, Juan Gedeon, was even on the book, I had written three scripts already. So, and I think you'll see this, but the first three scripts, you can tell that we're not quite in sync yet. Right? We're kind of like, we're like in the same book, but we're not on the same page yet. Mm-hmm. And the very first script that I wrote, knowing that he was going to be the artist on the book, was Horizon 4. And from that issue, I have felt that the book has kind of leaped forward in quality, you know, just on several different levels. And the stuff that we're doing now is really, really exciting because we are on the same page. Like, I am understanding how to script things to kind of make it easier for him to digest and produce great pages. And, you know, we're developing like a, you know, like a cool shorthand where it's like, oh, well, remember that panel that you did from, you know, issue 3 on that page? Let's do it like that, but reverse it. So it's a lot of it's a lot of fun. I mean, there's no greater feeling when that art starts to come back, when it's no longer just words, right? It's no longer just words and some, you know, fucking PDF, you know, it is actually transformed into something else. You know, it feels alive all of a sudden. And I enjoy the process. I love when the art comes back. I love when the colors come in. I love doing that final lettering script, like that final pass at the lettering, which is kind of like my one last chance to like change things. But it's been great. And I've loved working on Horizon, and I've just started working on the Lionforge thing, which is still a bit of a secret, but I just turned in the first official script, and my editor loved it. So I was very, very happy about that, because, you know, you always have that moment, you know, where I have this like this page, you know, a typical comic script now is 20 pages. And yes. I have this thing where when I get to about 17 or 18, you know, I decide that like the whole thing is shit and it needs to be rewritten from scratch, but it's due in like a few days. So I don't have time to do that. So I just have to finish those last couple of pages and send it, and kind of like, it's like, I always feel like I'm holding my breath. You know, I'm waiting for the editor to get back to me and be like, oh yeah, this was nice. This was hot. I like this a lot. And then, you know, I definitely felt that with the Lionforge book, especially with it being the issue 1, you know, first issues are so difficult. And, I feel like I'm getting better, but I never really feel like I've written a dynamite first issue start to finish, not in 20 pages. If I had extra pages, you know, I would be fine. Like if every first issue was like 30 or 40 pages, I'd be like, oh, okay, I'm cool. But it's you know, it's a process, but it's a lot of fun when it works out. And you know, like you said, it's, I don't want to call it grueling. It's not grueling, but you have to be very disciplined. And you have to be you have to be decisive. That's something that you'll learn quickly. You have to be very decisive when you're working on these things. You have to make decisions, and you have to stick with that decision because once you send that script off, you know, typically you can't get back in and change it. I mean, obviously I won't tell you which script there are, but I've actually sent in scripts where there is a scene somewhere in there where I like, oh, okay, when my editor sends the notes back, I'm going to go back and I'm going to rewrite that entire scene because I hate it. And what happens, you'll send it in and your editor will like the scene and it'll be like, oh shit, now I can't go back and change it now. But it's a fun, very enjoyable process, and I just I love comic books. I love comic books so much, and I've loved them since I was 12 years old. And it's crazy. It's a trip being on the other side of that table. You know, like when you're at the publisher's booth and people are bringing a book up to you that you worked so hard on and poured yourself into, and it really connected with them on some, you know, on some level, hopefully multiple levels. But yeah, man, it's fun. It's fun.
Yeah. So with that being said, if you, any listeners are interested in learning more about this stuff, you know, we are always happy to answer questions on the Two Brandons Facebook group. Feel free to drop questions about the creative process. I mean, that's what we're here for.
Yeah.
You know, both of us have an extensive background with starting from scratch and also working with licensed properties. And, you know, a lot of us have stuff, and between the both of us, we have a lot of stuff coming out. So, you know, feel free to just connect and engage, and we'll always be there for you. It might take us a few days to get back to you, but we'll definitely be there. And we would be remiss before we take off to, you know, ignore what's just happened last week in terms of the presidential election of 2016. Now, I've already said how I felt. I made a video called Message to My White Liberal Friends about what steps we can take in the future and moving
ahead.
Great
video, too.
Thank you very much. It was just something off the top of my head, and I just wanted to say a few things about the world and where we're going to go. Now, the one thing I have to say, and I want to say to everybody listening and anyone who might be new to it, new to us, I would just say, you know, keyboard activism is great, you know, for certain things. But let me tell you this. Petitions don't really do anything. You know, emails don't really do a whole lot. I mean, it lets people know that you're out there. But the way to really make a difference with your congressperson and your political representation and all that other stuff, you got to call or visit their office. Don't be afraid to call, because you pay for the phones that they answer. You pay for that. We pay for it. If you pay taxes, you pay for everything in a congressional or senator's office, whatever it is. You pay the governor's office, the presidency itself. We all pay for that. So the reality of the situation is you have a right to call and complain. If you have issues, feel free to look it up. But I have a couple of links that not only have direct corporate headquarters of people who support the Trump administration financially, but I also have a list of what to say. I mean, a link to what to say when you call your senator or your congressperson or your governor's office or even the White House line. If you want to fight this storm that we're going to be in for the next maybe 4 to 8 years.
And it is a storm. This is not normal. This is not some normal shit. This is not just some, you know, this side won and this side lost and whatever. This is different. And this is not just happening in the United States. It is happening all over the world. It is this wave of anti-immigrant, anti-brown, anti-everything that is engulfing a lot of, you know, quote-unquote civilized countries right now. And if we want it gone, we're going to have to beat it back. And we're not just going to be able to sit around and just wait for it to just work out on its own. And I posted a, you know, I was pretty, I'm trying to control myself. I'm still pretty angry about it. I was very angry the week of, and I posted a lot of kind of angry, intense postings on my Facebook, which I typically try to avoid, but in this case I felt it was necessary. And, you know, don't wait. Don't feel like you can wait until this hits your personal doorstep before doing anything. You know, don't wait until it's your black friend or your Hispanic friend or your gay friend that, you know, goes into their school or goes to their home or is out in the street and they're being hollered at by people or confronted or intimidated. Like, you can't wait until it touches you. And, you know, and right. that's part of, that was part of the initial problem. That's why the result was the way it was, because it's really easy to disavow shit when you feel like it's not about you. Like, oh, well, he's not talking about me, so, you know, I'll be fine. It's like, no, you're not going to be fine. Like, eventually it will find its way to you too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just kind of sitting back and hoping for the best is not going to do it. So, Issa, I'm sorry. You can keep going.
Oh, no, no. I mean, no, nothing you're saying is wrong. I agree with everything you're saying. I guess for me, you know, my anger, because I can tell you what really hit me hard is that I've been wrong about two major things. I mean, I've been wrong about a lot of things, but the two major things in my life I've been wrong about politically. I didn't really think in 2004, was it, or 2003, we would actually go to war in Iraq, because I felt there's no way the American people would, you know, vote or sanction a war when we didn't have proof of the people who did it. I really believed, I had absolute faith in the American system that we would not go to war. And I was completely wrong. I was going around saying to people, look, there's no way we're actually going to go to war. And guess what? We did. And we're still paying for it.
Yep.
That was the first thing. The second thing I was wrong about clearly was Trump getting elected, because I believed that after all the horrifying, disgusting things he said about women, just women alone, like we're not even going to get into Muslims.
Just women. White women. Once he came for the white women, you would have imagined that it was over.
Right. Now, I thought, okay, all these women out there have, a lot of these women have daughters. A lot of these women just have sons who are going to marry other women. They have sisters and aunts and grandmothers. Like, I thought there's no way on earth women would go into the voting booth and put that guy into power. And an exit polling showed that, what was it, 53% or something like that of white women voted for Donald Trump.
Yes.
That's when I realized on some level that white women chose white over being a woman. Mm-hmm. Because regardless of what anybody says, this was a white rage backlash to many, many things that was compounded by the fact that rural white America have been completely destroyed by North American Free Trade Agreement and the further disillusion of industrial America.
Right.
Now, I'm not responsible for the end of industrial America. Muslims are not responsible for the end of industrial America. Mexican immigrants or any immigrants, period, are not responsible for the end of industrial America. The people who are responsible for the end of industrial America have just been put into office.
Right.
Have been reelected.
Yes.
Because a lot of the people who created this problem were reelected into the House and Senate, who created these problems.
Mm-hmm.
The people who Trump are assembling.
That's why.
You know, are the people who created these problems.
Right. That's why you can really, basically this whole like, oh, it was just about the economy. It's like, no, it wasn't.
No.
No. It was not. If it was about the economy, then every incumbent on the ticket would have gotten, you know, blasted into oblivion and thrown into a well. And that's not what happened.
Right. So that's where I was wrong, because I actually believed that. And this is something I said in my message to my white liberal friends video. I grew up in Baltimore with what people call poor white trash. I'm not calling them that, but that's what people would call them. Right. Like working poor whites.
Mm-hmm.
And those same people got laid off with their black brothers and sisters.
Yes.
At the docks the same time. So at least with certain communities, they couldn't blame African-Americans or Latinos, because those they got laid off with their Latino brothers and their Native American brothers. And in some cases, their Asian brothers, you know, they all got laid off together.
Right.
So you can't say, oh, it was the, you know, the Negroes and Spics and whoever else who cost me my job and costing my family to suffer. I am not belittling the suffering going on in white rural America, because the heroin epidemic, the crystal meth epidemic, the just pure frustration and fear that's going on in these small towns is horrifying. That does not give you a right to be racist.
Right.
Your suffering does not excuse homophobia, misogyny, xenophobia, racism, and anything else. So that's where I'm like trying to understand that I get that you're suffering, But that same suffering exists in poor black neighborhoods.
Has existed there for decades.
Right.
For decades.
So the trick is, you have to look at it at who's actually causing the problem. Already, Trump is planning to gut Medicare and Medicaid. Who are the primary beneficiaries of Medicare and Medicaid in the United States? Poor rural whites.
Yep.
Who are the primary beneficiaries of what do you call food stamps? Is ACE, what is it called?
Is it SNAP?
Yeah, well, SNAP is the other one, but it's AFDC, Aid for Families. Yeah, AFDC, Aid for Families with Dependent Children. Who are the primary beneficiaries of food stamps and welfare in the United States of America? Poor rural whites. So the people that you guys put into power are going to take away the razor thin safety net that you barely had.
Right.
They're taking that away. They're going to gut Social Security. Who's on Social Security? Retired rural whites. Like everyone else. I mean, it's like you've destroyed your own Social Security and safety network because you're voting along racial anger and racial fear and racial frustration lines instead of looking at the people who you're putting into power. And I think that what we've got to do is have an actionable plan for resistance. It's not about whining and complaining anymore. It's not about clicking like and sharing and signing petitions. You've got to call. You've got to say, I am withdrawing financial support from any company that supports the Trump administration. You've got to say, you have to call your congressperson and your senator and say, I don't like the fact that he's put a white supremacist as his chief, like Steve Bannon,
right,
his chief strategist. That guy's half of his, so far, almost 60% of his new cabinet positions are filled with white supremacists and hate mongers.
Yes.
I mean,
they already said, Reince Priebus was on something like State of the Union. He already said that the guy that's up for Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is going to stop the intrusive civil rights investigations of police departments all around the country.
Yep.
And again, that's one of those little things. And, you know, I hate this question, you know, when people are complaining and they're like, well, what did Obama do for black America? Like, Obama didn't do anything for black America. It's like, well, his Justice Department investigated all of these, you know, local police departments and found widespread racial, you know, discrimination. That's something. You know, that is something that is very tangible that now people are not going to have access to now. So now when, you know, if some, you know, tragedy happens where some unarmed man gets shot by the police, you know, the federal government is basically telling you they're not interested in investigating that. So whatever your local police department decides is going to be the story or the explanation, that's going to be the end of it.
And that's terrifying because even with a black president, even with a black attorney general, there was significant resistance to federal probes of police misconduct. Now, with people who are in agreement with those people who would shoot unarmed blacks or beat up. This is something that a lot of people don't know. The group of people who are most killed by police are Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And most people don't even know that because there's such a media emphasis on African-American deaths. They have completely ignored and in some cases covered up how many Native Americans have been unarmed Native Americans have been shot and murdered by police officers across the country. And that's something I found out when I started doing the research. So we're in a pickle, folks. But this is another thing. Get on the mailing list for the Southern Poverty Law Center, the SPLC. Get on their mailing list because they're keeping a daily total of how many hate crimes are occurring since the Trump election. And they are also have on their site a action plan for resistance. So please, by all means, get involved. Go to the Southern Poverty Law Center website. It's SPLC. I think it's SPLC.org. If I'm right, I believe it's that. And check out what's going on. Sign up. They give you an action plan. There's also a group called Wellstone, and it's wellstone.com. Wellstone.com also has an action plan for resistance to what we're going to be dealing with. So please get involved, folks. You don't have to go marching in the street, because protesting doesn't always do anything. But what does do make an impact is when you directly engage with politically elect with your elected officials. Also, do not be afraid to run yourself. You might not have the money and you might not win, but guess what? You can learn about the process and educate yourself and other people. And I really believe in that. And that's what I have to say as far as, you know, what's going to happen in the future. I don't know. All we can do is watch out for each other and just be there. That's it. That's all you can do. That's all I have to say, you know, as far as that's concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have much to add. I just, you know, this is going to be, you know, everyone must remain vigilant. You know, keep your eyes open at all times now, especially when you're out by yourself.
Especially the women, because they're basically messing with women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So just keep an eye on that. If you're a woman of color, keep your eyes open. And by the way, it's SPLC. It's basically SPLCenter.org, not SPLC. So it's SPLCenter. I'm going to share the link on the to Brandon's podcast Facebook group, mm-hmm. just so folks can get involved and sign up, because they have an actionable plan for everything we need to deal with in the future.
And then also, this is just, you know, me personally, other places to consider making donations to the next few years, the ACLU,
absolutely,
Planned Parenthood, because reproductive rights are definitely going to be something that is under constant threat and attack, and pay for real investigative journalism. Consider buying a subscription to the Washington Post or the
Guardian
or the New York Times. And, you know, we just, like you said, we have to keep our eyes open, look out for each other, and don't delude ourselves. Don't tell ourselves that, you know, it's just going to be all right and nothing is going to happen. So, I mean, who even knows? Who even knows what's going to happen in the next couple of years? But I would definitely say that we will have to be very vigilant regarding women's reproductive rights and about voting rights. Because if you think voting was difficult, intentionally difficult in this election, that will only continue.
Yep.
Because the easier it is to vote, the harder it is for people to maintain their power and their political dominance over people.
Absolutely. And there you go.
All right. So I think that's it. I think that's a nice, meaty installment. you know, last thing I want to put in your guys' ear, the first official trade collection of Horizon will be in stores. Let me check. I believe it's January 17th. Let me check that. I'm sorry, January 18th. So the first collection will be in stores. It'll be the first six issues, and it'll also launch on the exact same day as issue 7 is available in stores. So we will be making a huge, huge concerted push to encourage people to check out the book that either just got the first issue and decided to trade weight or haven't even gotten any issues at all. And the sales on that trade will determine basically how long we get to tell the story, whether it'll be, you know, 16 issues or who knows how many issues. So that's going to be a big focus point for me going forward. So you'll see me talking about that a lot in the coming months. And there'll also be a couple of cool things that we have planned for that. There'll be a signing tour and there'll be a couple of details about that. But that trade will be out, and it's a very important benchmark for us, both creatively and even financially. So I appreciate everyone who has checked out the book so far, and it's only going to get better. It's getting better with every single issue. We have 5 issues available right now. Issue 6 will be out in stores, I believe, mid-December. It'll end that first arc with a bang, a big, you know, out of control, you know, superhero fight, a couple of cool reveals and teasers for what's going to happen next into the second arc. And be on the lookout for that.
And I will be buying it because I've got every issue. I mean, I have been supporting
you floppies. And my mother.
Yeah, I mean, I've been supporting floppies lately. I generally don't try, like, depending on what it is. Like, I'm really behind on a lot, so I have this massive pyramid of books in my table that I need to get to. But when it comes to Brandon Thomas's stuff, especially since it had been a while since I'd really gotten the chance to read some new material from Thomas, I was very happy that Horizon dropped, and it's a great read. So I'm definitely looking forward to having it. Plus, I feel like Image books read a lot better when you have them as one collection.
They do.
So
they do.
I will definitely have I'll be supporting it from now on, and as like I did from the first issue. So keep up the good work, man, and I'll be there for it.
Thank you. Thank you. And congratulations again on the Vampire Hunter D sellout. And I can't wait to read more. I loved that first issue. Loved everything about it. The narration, the artwork, the action. I loved the twist at the end. I thought it was really well done. It was one of my favorite things that you've done so far. Really up there with the Andre the Giant graphic novel. So I'm really, really anxious to see where that goes. And I'm anxious to get in the mask. I know that launches in a week or two.
Yeah, Mask number 1 for the ongoing series drops on Wednesday, November 30th. I will be doing, I don't know when this is going up, but I will be doing a signing at the Comic Bug, I believe in Culver City, all day long on Wednesday, November 30th. I'll also be doing a Vampire Hunter D signing at Heidi Ho Comics in Gardena, I believe. There's a couple other things going on, but I'll make sure that people know. But yeah, Mask number 1 will come out then, the ongoing series. It looks fantastic. I cannot wait for people to see it. For all intents and purposes, you know, Vampire Hunter D issue 1 is sold out. But if you can get your hands on the first print, do it before it's gone, because the second print is now available for pre-order. And the second print of issue 1 will be in stores on December 14th, 2016. And that's about it for that.
All right. Thank you, guys. Thanks for dropping by. Hopefully it won't be quite as long before we do this again. And thank you for all the support this summer at the shows. I know I had a great time. I'm assuming Easton did, too. It was great meeting.
Oh, yeah.
It was great meeting a lot of you in person. And, you know, we'll be around. Find us online. Find us on the Two Brandons Facebook page. And we'll see you next time. All right. So this is Brandon Thomas.
And this is Brandon Easton, and take care, folks.
We'll see you next time. Be safe out there.